You're listening to Myerside Chats, a show that aims to eliminate the unhealthy us-and-them narrative in every community. Join community leader Evan Meyer as he breaks down the toxic polarization. In these authentic conversations, he showcases everyday heroes in public service and reconnects city residents with their political leaders. In this safe space, we honor different points of view that will help build stronger, more resilient, and more inclusive communities everyone would love to be a part of. Here is your host, Evan.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining another Myerside Chats. It is my pleasure to introduce Cesar Hidalgo. He is a Chilean Spanish-American scholar known for his contributions to economic complexity, data visualization, and applied artificial intelligence. Hidalgo leads the Center for Collective Learning at the Artificial and Natural Intelligence Institute at the University of Toulouse and the Corvinus Institute for Advanced Studies at Corvinus University of Budapest. He's also an honorary professor at the University of Manchester. Between 2010 and 2019, Hidalgo led MIT's Collective Learning Group. Prior to working at MIT, Hidalgo was a research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Hidalgo is also a founder of DataWheel, an award-winning company specializing in the creation of data distribution and visualization systems. He holds a PhD in physics from the University of Notre Dame and a bachelor in physics from Universidad Católica de Chile. Hidalgo's contributions have been recognized with numerous awards, including the 2018 Lagrange Prize and 3 Webby Awards. Hidalgo is also the author of dozens of peer-reviewed papers and of 3 books, Why Information Grows, The Atlas of Economic Complexity, and How Humans Judge Machines. He has presented in more than 200 events, including keynote and invited talks at academic conferences and professional events. He's presented at TEDx and the World Economic Forum, and at both Davos and the annual meeting of New Champions. Sir, it is a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Evan. It's a pleasure for me to be here today.
I've inspired when I saw your TED Talk. I think it's a revolutionary way of thinking, and it made me see what's possible. It gave me a lot of hope. And as I've learned more about your work, it shows that you can do something this exciting and this revolutionary, but also in a thoughtful way. So I think that got me really excited to have this conversation. And I believe that you are the perfect person to be having this conversation. My background in local politics is made me even more interested because I see all the flaws in local politics. And I see how much room there is for growth when it comes to voter turnout, when it comes to voter knowledge, cognitive bandwidth, what people think they understand and how they look at various issues versus just complain about things, right? And all of this gets harder and harder as you go from local to regional to state to national understanding of issues. So with that said, what do you see is the biggest problem with democracy today?
I think democracy has a number of problems today. And I think one of the problems that we do have is that we have systems in which we are required to elect bundles of proposals or preferences through political parties or through politicians that at the end of the day have pushed us towards forms of polarization or political discussions that are not the most constructive. I do think that we have advanced to the point in which we value democracy as a form of governance. We agree that decisions need to be made collectively, but we have reduced that ability to make collective decisions to relatively simple choices over candidates rather than proposals. And that has generated incentives in several sides to have a conversation that is not ideal. So on the side of the candidates, it generates incentives to get candidates that really have enormous egos and are able to survive a very vicious political life. And on the other hand, on the perspective of individuals, have learned to develop identities based on our politics. We take a strong identity on what we believe, but these are identities that are quite simplified, being a Democrat, being a Republican, being conservative, being a liberal, that we have lost the nuance of the discussion in which samples, and I've seen this with data, people often agree on more things that they disagree on. But because we have to identify with these camps and because we have to make these all or none decisions, we end up fighting more than discussing our points of agreement or how we can make our decisions collectively better.
Yeah, you said a number of things there that really struck home. And one is politics is not about credentials. I don't know what percentage of it is about credentials, but that's been one of the hard things to grapple with, and to have to build an identity around different issues or groups, and then not even think about the politics, but whether or not you're identifying with being a Democrat or a Republican, or if Republicans put forth a bill, you know, you don't like, you could, or that you like, you can't even say that you like that bill at this point because you'd be identifying with being a Republican. And you could never do that, God forbid, or a Democrat, God forbid, depending on which side you're on. So that's really challenging. It's a weird state that we're in right now.
And we didn't get here by accident. There is this book by Ezra Klein that has a very cleverly written introduction that tells a story in which in the 1950s, the United States was not as divided as it is today in terms of politics. And the evidence of that is that a lot of people would split the vote, meaning that they would vote for, let's say, a Republican at the state level and for a Democrat at the federal level. And that happens less and less. Now, splitting the vote is very rare. You know? And what he says is that, well, in the 1950s, political scientists were worried about that because they say, in a world in which people don't see strong differences between candidates from different parties, they're not making well-informed decisions. We need parties that are well-differentiated. We need parties that, in some sense, kind of confuse with one another, because otherwise people are making decisions among things that might be confused and might not be clear, and they push toward this development of strong differentiation between parties. And they succeeded on that program, but in some sense, the success of that program was the failure for our society because it developed a change, and that's the argument that Ezra makes in this book, in which people change from having an identity of maybe I'm a middle income family man from the Midwest to I'm a Republican or I'm an East Coast liberal and so forth. And now when we're talking about politics, we're not having a difference about ideas. We're having a fight for our identity, for our lives. And that change in the 50s, maybe other forms of identity became more important. And today, political identity has become so important that people are not willing to give an inch, because you're not giving an inch in an idea, in a discussion, a debate. You're giving an inch of your identity. And basically, that's something that is very intimate and hard to lose. So we got here because we thought we were making things better by differentiating parties, helping people choose better. But maybe when parties were more similar and ideas could be shared more easily among them, the state was better to start with, and we might have made a mistake.
Do you think any of that has to do with the loss of being particularly religious, or the devaluing religion to what it used to be? Or at least a lot of people have lost their faith and they have taken up politics as a religion, at least from what I've seen. Do you see that that's part of the issue, and they're forming identities with that, which they normally would have formed that with God? Or with,
just to cite another colleague, you probably heard of Stuart Kaufman. He's generally an MD. He became famous in the 1960s in the studies of fruit flies, and then eventually developed all of these theories about complexity and how organisms adapt and evolve and all of that. But he has a number of popular books, and one of those books is called Reinventing the Sacred. And the book centers on this argument, which is that at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, whether you're an atheist or not, we have some sort of need for spirituality, and we're gonna put it somewhere. So yeah, maybe in Argentina, soccer plays that role. Like, people are really big fans of their national soccer team and their neighborhood soccer teams. And in the US, to some extent, you do have big fans of some of these sports, and that plays a role. But this can play that role as well. I do think that we do have, like, this, let's say, unconditional love to give to a group, which is something that I think religion does build on. I do think that there's something quite natural about that. We want to have that sense of belonging when sometimes we do feel lost as a person, if we don't feel that we belong to something larger. And in that case, we could have a transfer from that need to this different entity or this different group phenomena that would be politics rather than religion. Now, I'm speculating here, but I do think I'm not the only one that has been speculating in this direction. There is this need for us to belong to groups, to have a strong emotional attachment to them. That's something that is very much present in religion. And when religion disappears, it doesn't go away. People might search for that elsewhere. And that might be something of what's going on here.
Yeah. And it's funny you say sports, even in fitness, people, yoga is the easiest example in the fitness category where that can become very devout. It actually gets into spirituality a bit. It crosses the line between fitness and spirituality sometimes. But sports is a huge one, and people will fight over that. It's politics becomes the intellectual form of the physical sports. But all of these are just, I think that's an interesting way of putting it, where there's an unconditional love that people need to give to something.
There's another dimension here, which I think is interesting. I had a colleague at MIT who was called Henry Lieberman, and one of the things that he did was that together with his team, they had collected a lot of data on common sense reasoning. Okay, so this was before GPT chat and all of those things. I'm talking about like the AI of 2009, 2010. And one of the things that people struggled with was common sense reasoning, the thing that water goes inside the cup, not on the cup, and all of those type of statements. And when they looked at this corpus of data, they realized that the first dimension of the common sense reasoning was a moral dimension, was looking at good or bad things. Okay, so it's not the clean socks and the dirty socks. We make shortcuts. It's the good socks and the bad socks. It's like the good pair of pants. It's like you have two cars, the good car and the bad car. This moral shortcut is a very easy way for us to think about the world, because sometimes describing things more precisely is cognitively demanding. So we have like this dimension in which we either dislike something or we find that it's good or bad, and we organize the world in that way. Now, when we bring this to what we were just talking before, which is this belonging to groups, we want to feel that we are part of the good group. So religion is very much tied to some morality. If you practice a religion, there's a certain code of conduct that you consider to be virtuous and that you try to follow. Nationality has a component as well. I'm an American citizen. I understand that the identity of being American, in part, is an identity that is associated with some sort of virtue that gets blended into that cultural identity. But when you like a sports team, you like the good guys. You don't like the bad guys. And when it comes to politics, you have the same. When it comes to food, people can be very opinionated and moralistic about food. I'm a vegan, or I'm a vegetarian, or I know here someone doesn't eat vegetables, like the opposite of a vegetarian. And they take them very seriously in each one of them. But if you simplify it, if you look, whether it is a sports or whether it is food or whether it is religion or whether it is whatever group you are belonging to, there is a simplification in which you're always on the side of the good guys. And that simplification, I also think, is important because it's not just developing a sense of identity, it's developing a sense of identity in which you see yourself as morally virtuous. And that, of course, generates a conflict when you have groups that are very well defined, because both groups look at themselves as morally virtuous. Like in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats in it themselves, they're going to look at themselves as the good guys of that movie.
And not even just morally virtuous, but sanctimonious, where, not to play on a recent political thing that's been going around, but there's something about that you can see even in places where you wouldn't expect it. You wouldn't necessarily think that places that are not religious and are very healthy, let's just say in general, like a Los Angeles, they don't tend to be as religious and don't tend to be, and they tend to be particularly healthy, but can still, after overcoming so many things, sometimes I think people lose perspective of after, let's just say you found things that work better for you. They work better for you. They don't work better for everyone. But then to lose empathy, right? There's a loss of perspective and understanding, even though your parents feel that way, maybe even. And people have divorced their families because of politics these days, right?
Across the world, not just an American phenomenon, like across the world, I think we are in a world in which the center has lost. There's only in a few countries in which politicians from the center are still being elected, but they're fewer and fewer. And we are entering this, let's say, late stage of representative democracy in which countries are getting stuck on these very hard swings between the left and the right. And I think the United States, we know we have more recently entered that cycle. If you think about, let's say, in the 90s, someone like Clinton was still a little bit of a centrist for today's standards, quite a lot in many ways, being maybe a little bit more open in terms of economics, but a little bit more, let's say, liberal, but not so much in terms of social issues compared to people today. And now we don't have that anymore. And I think it's disappearing. I live in France. In France, we do have a centrist right now. And I think it might be the last centrist of France for a while, because the next election is going to be one of his rivals to the left or to the right that is going to eat maybe that center where he's in right now. And Argentina is going through the cycles. Brazil is going through the cycles. Chile is going through the cycles. It's an accelerating oscillation that we're observing in politics around the world, which is concerning because it's not the same as being in the middle when you're going violently from one side to the next. I think a lot of things is getting built and destroyed, and I don't think it's a very stable situation.
No, it's psychologically unhealthy too. And what's always boggled me is why people will get so hung up on things that they have nothing to do with, are not willing to change or get involved in anything to do in any capacity other than share things on social media and somehow think that's helping the situation. But the willingness to participate is not really there, but people, it's a psychological phenomenon to me that someone, it's almost the same thing that would bother or affect a relationship in a marriage. It's like very similar to the type of thought patterns that I believe are affecting a person's relationship with politics and the rest of society. They're very close in terms of the way that you would hope to treat another person, right? The way that you would hope that you can communicate effectively, the way that you would think that the person can garner enough information, learn enough and share and hear perspective and share perspective and ultimately come up with a well-rounded, holistic, and empathetic approach, even if they radically disagree.
Did you ever watch the movie The King of Comedy?
Have I seen The King of Comedy?
Like Jerry Lewis, Robert De Niro, Sandra Bernhardt.
So, oh, yeah. You know what?
Did you watch The Joker?
The new Joker?
The recent Joker movie? It's a rip-off of The King of Comedy many ways, because The King of Comedy is about Jerry Lewis being this very famous late-night host and Robert De Niro being this like low-level New York character, like the Joker type of character, which fantasizes about becoming a comedian in this show. And eventually with Sandra Bernhardt, which is like this rich but cuckoo high-class New York gal, they kidnap Jerry Lewis. And it's all because Robert De Niro's character has this imagination in which he's thinking about him being on the show and telling those jokes and being liked by everyone and so forth. And it shows that an aspect of American reality, which I think was very poignant, especially at that time, and I think it has grown since, which is a society divided between people that are relatively lonely and celebrities, which are people that are gathering an enormous amount of attention, and people fantasizing about being in contact with those celebrities. And this is known in psychology that basically people tend to think that they have a close relationship with people that are famous simply because they hear so much about them that in some sense there is a familiarity to them. But when they would meet them, of course, the famous person doesn't know them back, and that generates a huge clash. And I think American society, being a society that is so media-centric, we have in some way evolved into a state in which a lot of people are interacting in a way that is mediated and is through these celebrities. So yes, it's this person that has been on my living room every night for years. But that person in reality is a character from television or a host on a TV show. They don't know you, but they have become in some way a member of your family. The media has engineered that closeness as well. That closeness now, like, it translates into politics in which now you're interacting through these characters, through these identities that are developed. And it's a symptom of would be considered a rather lonely society, because what I find is that I only talk about famous people when I'm with people that I don't know very well. But when I'm with people that I know very well and we have a lot of friends in common, we talk about our friends in common. We talk about like the other people that we know. And in some sense, all of that world of fame and celebrities and power disappears into the background because we have our own little life that is filled here. But if that disappears, all that is left is the connection to the gods.
Yep.
And I see that as part of these micro mechanisms that lead to the psychology that you were describing.
And it all actually, the generation that is mostly sitting in their room watching TikTok or and not developing close personal relationships or intimate relationships with friends and family because they're in the room, I could see that becoming even worse. That's a catalyst for the type of behavior you're talking about.
Yeah, that's our struggle now. It's like getting kids out of the screens. And like I put my daughter on the summer camp or these other activities because, yes, we have to get them out of the house to get them out of the screen and to interact with people. And I think a lot of parents that have kids around the age that I have, like my daughter is 9 right now, feel identified with this struggle.
Let's jump in a little bit to see, now that we've understood a number of the problems here, augmented democracy, this fascinating concept. We're talking about a lack of perspective. We're talking about cognitive bandwidth or time to be able to understand issues. To be able to understand, the way I see it, as understanding issues means understanding perspective. Mm-hmm. Understanding how it affects the most amount of people, how any issue can affect the most amount of people, why it's the right, someone who is representing people, is a good representative of people, whether it's your local or state politician, when they think about what's good for everybody, not just what's good for them and their people. And that's what we've got to also now, where you're condemning one group and you're praising another for their values. And this is tricky. Can augmented democracy help solve the issue of perspective in addition to just cognitive bandwidth?
Yeah. So first, let's talk a little bit more like what this augmented democracy idea is. And the idea of augmented democracy is the idea of using AI agents, basically software that would live on some sort of personal cloud, to help represent individuals and their preferences in a way in which we could have levels of representation that are much more direct and nuanced than the ones that can be afforded through representative forms of democracy. Okay? So a world in which people are represented by their issues and by their preferences rather than their allegiance or loyalty to a candidate. And this is an idea that, as you mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, it was in this TED Talk I presented in 2018, and that I had the chance to explore a little bit in 2019 when there was a big revolution in Chile. So in 2019, there was a revolution that started late in October in which everything was normal, let's say on a Wednesday. And on Saturday morning, over 70 subway stations had been burned or damaged. There were a large number of places that had been vandalized, and the country woke up to a state of chaos and uncertainty that honestly, I had not seen during my life. And within that context, together with people in my software company, we organized as a small citizen group. And we created a platform that grabbed 90 proposals in the beginning. These were things that people were voicing out on the internet, on Twitter, or in other places as potential causes of this revolution, so people could help prioritize them collectively. Okay, so these were things like increase the minimum wage or improve pensions. Or there were other things that were more political, create a new constitution, or there were things that were more frivolous, legalizing marijuana and so forth. And we created this new form of social media, to put it in a very simple way, in which people could collaborate to prioritize these proposals. And we discovered, first of all, that people were willing to participate. We collected over a period of about 3 to 4 weeks, over 7 million preferences from the population of people that came to participate. Also, we found that for the most part, there was a large amount of agreement in the population. Everybody thought that minimum wage was a big problem or that pensions were a big problem. And we could identify issues that were the source of disagreement. And these issues that were the source of disagreement were interesting because there was part of the population that believed they were really important and they were the cause of the conflict. And part of the population believed that they were not the source of the conflict, they were a distraction they were not important. So they would put them to the bottom or the top of the ranking, depending on which side they were on. And one of those issues, for instance, was the idea of a new constitution. It was a very polarizing proposal. And Chile then underwent a constitutional process that started about 6 to 8 months after we launched this platform from the beginning of the revolution. And that constitutional process failed. And it was very controversial. And now there's a second constitutional process underway, which it's unclear whether it's going to lead to a new constitution or not. So I did find there is a world in which you can build some of these digital technologies and people might be willing to try them. They might be willing to roll the die at the moment that everything breaks, at the moment that Twitter and the TV news are just flames. They're willing to try those things. And we found that they work. The data, the information that we're getting was very reasonable. And it involved a platform in which people were, even though divided, they were forced to collaborate because the platform did not allow you to comment, did not allow you to fight with another person. It only allowed you to participate in a collaborative game in which no matter whether you were from the left or the right, you were all contributing towards the same goal.
Yeah. And to bring it back, most people do tend to think similarly on a lot of things, and we've divided them in media, we've divided them through identity politics, and a lot of it reminds me of Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, a great book. But for those listeners who haven't read it, it seems that there is so much opportunity here, and one of the things that you've mentioned, I don't remember if it was on this podcast or I read it, but about that there, it's about starting small. Right, to be able to show that you can use something like an augmented democracy that can be an assistant, not a replacement, right? Just to be clear, yeah. And for the cognitive bandwidth problem, for the amount of bills, for the amount of reading, for the amount of understanding that's required, if you start small, you can prove that this can work in things that are relatively inconsequential. Right? Or even just in an experimental toy version, I know you like to call it, but where can we start that's pretty small that can show that we can solve the cognitive bandwidth issue around what we're willing to spend our time on and learn? And how can we show and prove through some of these smaller activities, maybe what some of those activities are, or examples, not necessarily activities, but examples where this could work in small instances?
I would separate what it means to work into two things. One that is, let's say, contextless, and another one that is context specific. So from a contextless perspective, I do think that we could try using these voting systems or paradigms in situations in which we are, maybe even if it's a large scale, playing with low stakes type of phenomena. So for instance, let's say, I talked with my students about building this idea. We never managed to do it, but let's say we were to run a contest about Instagram photography. There's a lot of people that participate in Instagram photography, and let's say we make categories, landscapes, portraits, you know, animals, whatever. You know? And the way that we ran that contest was by having some of these voting mechanisms as the way to find the winners and assign certain prizes. And we could use something that is as low stakes as that, because if this puppy wins or this puppy wins in the pet category, it's not a big deal. Hopefully we want the pictures to actually be good, but it's a low stakes type of thing. But we could start figuring out, how do we avoid bots gaming this? How do we avoid cheating? How do we make the system fair? How do we keep people engaged? Like, how often they want to participate? How often they want to run a contest? And like, we could explore many of those things in a low-stakes environment that is in the wrong context, because that's not a political context. And then you have the question of, how do you get this to work in the right context, which is politics, which is much different because that's a high-stakes context. So in the political side, I think we have had a few chances in which we have seen the plane fly, to use a metaphor. And I like to use that metaphor because I say that the Wright brothers are credited and by invented the airplane, not because they crossed the Atlantic. It's because the first flight was literally like several seconds long. They were able to keep a plane off the ground enough for other people to say, okay, no, it's flying, but they're not really going to the moon or crossing the Atlantic. It's that like short period that validates the idea. And then there is a long sequence of events that helps perfect that technology and bring it to the scale and reliability that allows you to feel safe bringing paying customers across an ocean. No? And to me, in 2019, for a few weeks, we observed that plane flew. There was a while in which there were hundreds of thousands of people participating on that platform. And they were engaged with the results that were being discussed on television as the things that maybe could help solve the conflict by senators of the Republic. That was flying. And it was during a short period of time. It was flying not in calm winds during a very stormy period where there were lots of other things going on. But it showed validation in the right context, but in a short time scale. And I think you want to try to explore both things. You sometimes could go into the right context in a small scale or in a short time period, get lessons from that. It is difficult because it's a very complex context, but you could also develop a lot of those things in other contexts that are not as heated, they are lower stakes, and that could help you identify many of the mathematical and user interface problems that at the end of the day, we're going to have to figure out.
Yeah. And getting to trust the system, right? For people to be able to want to put their data into an algorithm that will, you know, tell them how they feel about a certain thing.
Or that allows them to communicate and express, because that's like the thing that we have right now too, is that we live in a social media environment in which few people post, many people watch. And the problem of political participation is also one that is difficult in the sense that expressing your opinion is something that people don't do that willingly, especially openly. It's good that votes are secret and they're private in because of that in part and other reasons. But if we want to have higher frequency of participation, we might need some support for that participation through some technology that can preserve privacy, but can understand you well enough that could, you know, help increase the frequency with which you participate. Because that's something that we've learned, and there are many systems like the ones that I described that have been deployed in political and non-political contexts. And the levels of participation when these systems work is very high for a very short period of time. And then crickets, people disappear and they stop using these platforms. To me, that was one of the motivations of the ideas of augmented democracy. I know that some of this engagement can happen, but sustaining engagement or participation for a long period of time is difficult. Could we learn enough in that short period of participation to help get more juice out of the same orange? Is to stretch that participation using machine learning methods that learn from the participation that we've given to help us provide more participation per unit of attention.
Yeah. And something that I guess I even think about is the feedback that makes people feel comfortable that when they've participated, that we are in alignment with the algorithm or the support mechanism, the avatar, whatever, is in alignment with the way you actually think, and that consistent feedback. And it's that, to me, is one of the things that I know would make me feel comfortable, where it's like the incremental levels of feedback and trust building.
Now, as we then call it, the algorithm, in the sense that I always been proposing this idea as like one algorithm per person or one system per person that is highly personalized, because I think that's another motivation, sorry to interrupt you, but like another motivation that to me is really important, is that with the level of technology that we have and the democratic systems that are now in place, we are basically standing on a razor's edge in which, on the one hand, we have what is probably more likely, which is autocracy powered by artificial intelligence and digital technologies. And we might be going in that direction. Artificial intelligence makes surveillance much easier and control and all of that stuff. Or we might go into this way that I am proposing, which is much more difficult and much more unlikely, which is a more distributed form of governance in which technology allows us to escape the autocratic tendencies of representative systems in which power gets concentrated. And that's why I think it's really important to emphasize that it's not the algorithm, because otherwise we communicate an autocracy or a direction towards one. And there's many algorithms, as you have people, and these algorithms are in some sense in some constant dialogue, and there's an emergent outcome that we believe that is better than any centralized decision-making system. So a little bit like the difference between the market and central planning, applying this into our context of democracy.
Do you think that eventually, because to me, it does make, especially if you're trying to push this forward in the beginning, it's a support mechanism. It's not just trust the algorithm, right? It's support. You're asking for help so that you can do more with less, right?
Yeah.
At some point, as things get better, support becomes more like thinking for you in a lot of cases, right? And you could see how that, as the AI gets better, is there a point where it gets better at thinking about our own feelings and values than ourselves?
I wouldn't rule that out, but I think the right question is, does it get better at thinking about or about making collective decisions than our current collective decision-making system? Because, yes, it might not be better than us individually, but the problem is that individually, we're all very different, and we have to come to some sort of consensus or to some sort of agreement collectively. Right now, we have some sort of system to get to that collective agreement, which is a very contentious system that has like relatively little bandwidth, because just being part of the decision makers of that system consumes a lot of the energy of those that participate in it. Politics are very intense, not only on the policy making, but on the politics themselves. The question is, if we would have a system in which technology augments individuals and we can have an ensemble or a collection of agents that are deciding together, using information about their users, but without centralizing them in an individual algorithm, would they provide a better outcome than what we're doing right now for collective decisions? And I think there is a chance. I guarantee it, of course, because it's an empirical question. It would have to happen. But I don't think that we are at the optimum right now or close to it. I refuse to believe that this is the end of history. I refuse to believe that when I watch these sci-fi movies, I always find weird that in Star Wars, you can travel at the speed of light and so forth, and they have either an emperor or a non-functioning Senate. They're still stuck into kind of like institutions. I believe that there must be something beyond the institutions that we have discovered, and that democracy has to, at some point, catch to our technology. Yeah,
sure. And hey, the good news is you can blame the AI instead of each other.
Huh?
So maybe that's one of the benefits of introducing this third-party support system. We can reduce toxicity and the toxic polarity that plagues our whole world at the moment.
That's really important. Like in architecture, one of the things that people always emphasize in education is that one of the reasons why people are asked to build models is that by taking your idea out of your head and putting it on the table and everybody walking around it, criticism is not taken personal, because it's not, and you are wrong. It's not, this part of the house could be better or could be different. And even though it might sound a little bit like a joke, externalizing things provides maybe an easier way of discussing them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You're both looking at the same object, call it.
Yeah.
Instead of looking at each other, you now have the opportunity of looking at and converging
your
thoughts.
Object better. And that object better is maybe many systems in our society, the healthcare system, transportation system.
So this is one of the things that also, if we've already, we're way on the path where technology has outpaced policy by, I don't know, an order of magnitude of what needs to be done. And not just that, but it also can't correct the old policy. There's two parts of policy. How fast can you make new policy, and how fast can you remove the spaghetti code that is the current policy, the ordinance, the books and volumes of ordinances that don't make any sense anymore, that need to go away, that some code compliance officers, that thing, you're in trouble. And you're like, that thing's from 50 years ago. It doesn't make any more sense today.
And that's a big problem. Like when there are surveys on the literature on law and that try to assess how people feel about the legal system. And one of the things that people would agree on is that policies are not written in a way that is accessible or understandable, and that people do not have a full understanding of the law. So if you were to have a system that involves these forms of participation that might seem a little more simplified, would you get closer to that level of understanding in which people are not recipients of rules, but actually more aware of what those rules are, how they change? And I do love simplicity. I do think that sometimes few rules with a good emergent phenomenon are better than having so many details, but we are definitely on the opposite extreme. And we need all of these legal assistance in terms of lawyers and accountants just to operate in the world if you're doing anything a little bit interesting.
Exactly. A simple bill becomes a legal exercise. A simple way of looking at things that can be understood in a few words needs to become this pages long of legalese that no one's going to read, and it needs to be interpreted. And one of the things I always say is, if you want to go and understand, if you really want to understand the nature of the bill, read the bill. I wouldn't put my life on the line on a contract I haven't read yet.
Yes.
And you know that all that the rest is hearsay. Rest is just interpretation of a document that is up to interpretation anyway.
Exactly.
So why don't you make your own interpretation of the bill so you could say, this is what the bill said. There's a few very controversial bills here that I went back and looked at and to avoid getting political on it. I won't name the bills, but I went back and looked, and they made huge media attention, huge, big identity politics, like as far as it can go. And then I went and read the bill, and I'm like, wow, it doesn't say that at all. And the whole campaign was built on like a phrase that they just sold book after book, right?
Okay.
And you read the bill. It's one paragraph. You're just like, oh, wow, that's the thing they're talking about. It doesn't read that at all. But when you Google the bill, when you have to go find the bill, just Googling the bill is challenging. Just bill, it's a code. It's an alphanumeric code you have to go find very often.
So it's complicated. And I think that's a place where we have under-delivered. Like when the internet came along, governments were not the best web developers. And in some sense, that even became like a feature, became a form of digital operation that now we have. And we missed that opportunity because I do think that there was a moment, maybe in the late 90s, early 2000s, the moment when Wikipedia came of age and before, you know, social media took over the web, where there was like some sort of enthusiasm of trying to build things a little bit differently. And we failed, I think, because building these type of things is hard. And these are things that the private sector is not going to build because they don't have that direct business model that would require or that would justify getting all of those developers and all of that code and all of that thinking into the product as you need. So it's like a product design problem that we have, in which it's something that could be a great public good if we would design better even the sites that we have to interact with bills today. But it's really hard to develop them given the system that we have right now, in which the stakeholders are more distributed, and many times creating good software requires some relatively hierarchical executive structures in which shit has to get done. And software has to be very careful about the minutiae and things working and things not crashing and things being organized and coming up with systems. And that doesn't happen in committees. It happens with someone owning the job of the designer, like Steve Jobs did for his own products. But that doesn't happen, of course, for the website of the U.S. Congress, for instance.
No, they're in the biz. Well, their goals are different. It's not about efficiency and it's not about making it pretty. It's about trying to serve the most amount of people, which in generally I think is good if that's the goal of what you're trying to do, is serve the most amount of people. But you could be spending a ton of resources serving 1% of the population, right? You could be misguiding. The money could be misdirected to try to, for this ideal, when you're not actually serving 80% of the population that needs it just to work well, fix the problem, get me to the end zone. And it could save the government just so much money on like handwritten scanning things. And like the amount of inefficiency is like beyond. And the funny thing is, even on top of this, we look at what it means to be authoritarian or whatever at this like federal level. But when you look at the power that we give to people to spend our taxpayer money, and that we don't get to vote on any of that stuff, all of that money at the local level, not all of it, but all the things, like you don't vote on the stuff that is generally important, I think. Either the big issues, we'll call it like stuff around the major issues that we're dealing with in the country, or how money is spent at the city level that can handle trash, let's just say. We don't vote on any of that stuff. We delegate that power entirely. So there's this mix of like inefficiency, but also like we've allowed for that and our taxpayer and for people to take 100% control of that at these levels and just spend the money how they need to. Both of those seem...
That's hard because on the one hand, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen, you might ruin the soup. And and when it comes to some of these executive decisions, yeah, maybe you do want to trust someone to negotiate that contract with the garbage collection company, or which might be complicated to do and might require lots of details. So I do appreciate the labor, but at the same time requires a lot of trust on them doing the things right and for the right reasons and not providing these contracts to their cousins or to people that they're related to. On the other hand, when we've tried to distribute decision-making system at the local level through participatory budgeting, the problem with participatory budgeting initiatives is that it's really hard to get people to actually participate. They tend to focus on neighborhood improvement projects. They don't tend to focus on spending. It's usually like investment on playground, bicycle lane, and so forth. But it's hard to get citizens to contribute projects. No, it's hard to design a project to start with and to specify it and to communicate it in a way. And it has been hard to get people to participate simply because there's so much to choose that usually whatever gets voted on is whatever is on page one of a page that has multiple pagination of projects, which is the opposite of good participation design. It's an extremely biased form of participation that eventually defaults to what is easier and not necessarily what is best.
So it tends to be all the same people participating too in those local ones.
Yes, exactly. So I think there is also a space in which I believe there's a lot of potential. I do agree with you that at the end, controlling the money is where a lot of the real power is. If we were to control how our taxes are spent or how our cities finance projects, we would distribute a lot of power to the citizens by doing that. But that is a problem that is also extremely difficult. It's a very complex UI UX challenge. I don't think it is impossible, though. I think it is doable. But one of the things that I would be worried about is for which type of projects and when we want to do this, because I also do believe on the importance of executive decision making. And I do appreciate people that can do good executive decisions. We do need them. It's hard work.
Yep.
And it can be work that sometimes goes unappreciated.
Yeah. Things that you wouldn't want to do anyway. And they put the hard labor in to do it. And they should be appreciated. I suppose sometimes it's just a matter of not being, and this is where I always come to, it's if you are okay with that and you've made peace with yourself around that is what I'm putting my trust in, I have made that choice, right? These people can take that work. These group of people are representing me. I've made that choice. Whatever the choices that you make, you have to be okay with also the outcome and not become toxic because of it. And I think that's the funny human psychology balance where it's, okay, great. You're going to trust those people. So when they make a wrong decision about which trash company to use, you're okay with that because you've said that's a decision that you're trusting experts to take care of. You're trusting the people and that's okay. So a lot for me is like, in reducing toxicity, in getting people to see perspective better, it comes down a lot of times this personal accountability and responsibility of just accepting the choices that we've made already. You don't have to hate people for doing it wrong. You've already made the choice that you're going to trust them. That's the way it goes.
And I agree. And like in some sense, a lot of hate goes around for things that are happening in the public sphere, which might also be unfair and might be more of a reflection of how we feel than about how the system works.
Tell me, what is your vision for the world? All this work you've done, ton of experience, ton of awards, you've done so much great, incredible contributions. What do you want to see for the world in your lifetime that you're co-creating here?
I don't know if I have a vision for the world. I have a few things that I want to try to accomplish before I die. You know, that's what I could tell you. So I'm working, for example, now on a book that summarizes laws that govern the growth, diffusion, and valuation of knowledge. Knowledge is this quantity that, on the one hand, is part of our colloquial language, but on the other hand, it has been formalized in the academic literature in a number of ways, in psychology, in economics, in engineering, and so forth. And by now, I think it's going through a transformation, which is becoming a formal concept that can be understood in terms of principles. And these principles are important when you're thinking about innovation, because just like building a rocket requires you to understand about aerodynamics and chemistry and gravitation and so forth, if you want to try to engineer innovation in a certain place, you need to understand the forces that shape the growth and diffusion of knowledge so you can do it in a way that respects those natural principles or laws. So that's, for example, something that I would like to contribute. And I've been working hard in this book to help put all of that into a package that makes it easy to understand, but also that provides some novelty and insight to that space. I do this idea of digital democracy. I don't know how much I'm going to get to do with it, in part because personally, I'm not a very political person. I don't feel like going myself to fight for this idea in a heated political environment. I like to spend time with my family after work. And I understand that politics can be all-consuming and you have to dedicate to the construction of your political career. And you have to sacrifice other things that maybe I'm not willing to sacrifice, at least not yet, and maybe not ever. But I do think I can contribute to help develop some of the foundations for that type of work in terms of the mathematical models or user interface designs and principles of participation that could be used to bring us into a stage. So these are some of the contributions that I would like to make. I'm doing also a lot of work on collective memory to understand what is the information that gets preserved in our society and why, and how that varies with culture, with language, with geography. I find that to be quite interesting. It's more of a scientific endeavor. It's not necessarily because it has a policy implication, a technological implication. And on the private sector side, I have this company, DataWheel, that you mentioned in the beginning. And there we have, I think, made our mark on the design and creation of data distribution systems and platforms that are very visual, that allow people to interact with the data directly, that can be updated with a good level of frequency and so forth. And I think there's also potentially an important contribution on helping at least improve that part of the public sector, which is the data distribution, accountability, transparency side of things, by providing tools that can do this properly. And that's a lot of design and engineering work that I feel very proud about.
Awesome. Do you have one or two or three people that you consider heroes, alive or dead, that you really look up to, that inspire you?
Yeah, I do admire lots of people in history. There, of course, are going to be a little bit of cliches because then, you know, these are famous people. Like, I'm a big fan of Richard Feynman. I've been for a long time. I'm a physicist by training. When you see his videos, how he explains things, you understand that, like, he understands things so well and he can explain them so clearly that there is some sort of wisdom on his ability, his wits, his humor. So I do like that. I do like many entrepreneurs that I think they have been genius or very clever. People like Edwin Land, who was the creator of the Polar Corporation. I read a lot about him. I think he's amazing as well. He's an American psychologist, a mechanical engineer. He invented some of these methods of participation that, for example, the one that we use in Chile. He invented this law of comparative judgment in the 1920s. He was also one of the first people to study learning curves, which is one of these principles of the growth of knowledge. So I find that a lot of my interests converge to those of him. And he was a man that was very much ahead of his time. He's very well known within psychology, but he's not known at large like someone like Einstein or Feynman. But I think he's of that caliber, Leon Thurston. So people like that, I do admire a number of people. I admire a lot of musicians because I'm not coordinated like that at all. And I would love to be. I admire people in literature and poetry. So definitely, I always grew up admiring great minds in science, in the arts, engineering, et cetera.
Awesome. It's nice to hear. There's a lot. One of the reasons for that is question even is just to, it's a level of relatability for inspiration. I think there's a lot of that. It's one of the things that brings us all together is the thing that inspires. And it's nice to hear things that inspire you. So thank you. And I want to thank you for being here for this time with me. And I thoroughly enjoyed this. And I appreciate you sharing your insights with the world.
Thank you. And I enjoyed this very much too. And I hope it's not too hot today in Sedona here in Budapest. It has been quite hot today. So I'm happy to get off this oven and walk to my AC apartment.
It's probably a different kind of hot.
It's coming right now. Yeah, I think maybe we're going to have a thunderstorm soon. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good luck with that.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.